Hello and welcome to CNGM. My name is Pauline Hamsey-Vinson, Interim Director of the Center for Arab American Studies at the University of Michigan, Dearborn. The CNGM podcast highlights the voices of contemporary Arab American writers. It is brought to you by the Center for Arab American Studies at the University of Michigan, Dearborn, and the Arab American National Museum. We open today's episode with Wissam Al-Maliki reading from Jamila.
Hello, everyone. My name is Wissam Al-Maliki, and I'm very happy to join you here for the podcast theme, CNGM, and I'll be reading extracts from my two graphic novels. So for the first one, I'll read the second graphic novel, actually, which is Jamila. I'll read the first couple of pages where Jamila is introducing herself. Nubia, southern Egypt, where the Nile smiles. It doesn't always smile, though. It doesn't always speak, either. Sometimes it whispers, and sometimes it just glides. The copper bangles on my feet match its rhythm. The old tray on my head carries its gifts. The sweat on his forehead is a prism that glistens like the Nile as it drifts. We share the gifts of the gift of Egypt, as does a kind beast that rests. We share the shade and mint tea as we watch the birds in their nests. We share the water cooler made of clay, and we share the bread too. And the river watches all. It watches me, and it watches you. It watches me leave you, Idris, and sail its sister shades of green. It hears me explain that I have other tasks. Does it hear the questions my heart asks? Idris' house is close to ours. In our village, all houses shine. The colors of our village sing their song as I walk by. I hear the song and wonder, do they hear mine? My feet recognize stone. Stone differs from grass. Grass clings to feet. Stone is aloof, detached. There's affection in grass, but there's freedom in stone. Wood is alive. The sap still breathes inside. It talks to me. I am Jamila. My name means beautiful. Okay, this is for the second book, Why and Why. I'll be reading some of the poems. The book does not have a lot of dialogue in the middle, but it does have, and it's a black and white, a very different style I was experimenting with. And what it does have is lullabies and post-apocalyptic, so some of those are not very kind. Let's go to the amusement park. It's best when it's dark. Fireworks and Ferris wheel. Only this time, the fire is real. So the structure is a lullaby, but the words are very dark. I used to love paper books, but now I love Kindles and Nooks. At least I'd still be able to read when they burn all the books. And this one is for how a lot of countries find it very, actually pretty much most of the world, finds it very easy to get money for weapons, for a lot of things, but not for education, which is more important. Need more desks or writing tools? Money for wars, but not for schools. This one is about the pillaging of museums. And what we have over here is for Egypt, the Nefertiti statue, and many other artifacts from Egypt that have been taken abroad for during colonialism, but also some of that there are calls for destroying them because they're seen as taboo from ultra-conservative points of view. So I'm writing about both. Some were stolen, some were broken, some were taken as a token, some were booed and tabooed, or were taken as a loot. And then the last one refers to the title, Why and Why, which is the first two letters from my children's names, Yasmina and Yassine, but it's also the question why. And here it's about war and violence and false justifications for war. Don't tell your men why they kill. Tell the victims why they die. Tell them why. Tell them why. Well, that's it. And I hope you enjoyed this excerpt. And thank you very much.
And I have the pleasure today to interview one of my colleagues at the University of Michigan Dearborn, Wissam Al-Maliki. Wissam is Assistant Professor and Director of the Arabic Translation Certificate and the Comparative Literature Certificate at the University of Michigan Dearborn. Researching Arabic and comparative literature and language, as well as Arab cinema and art. His book, The Poetry of Arab Women from the Pre-Islamic Age to Andalusia, by Routledge in 2019, is a critical translation and anthology where he translated and collected more than 400 poems by around 200 Arab women poets, most of whom are translated and discussed for the first time in English. His recent book, Cultural Identity in Arabic Novels of Immigration, A Poetics of Return, published by Roman and Littlefield in 2020, examines Arab narratives about West and East encounters from the 12th to the 21st centuries, representing Arab countries including Egypt, Lebanon, Sudan, and Yemen. He also wrote and illustrated two graphic novels, Why and Why and Jamila. Today, we will be talking to Wissam about his graphic novels, and we will leave his academic work as part of the background to how it enters into these novels. But we'll focus mostly on the graphic novels and the creative writing. Wissam, welcome to the Sinjim podcast.
Thank you so much, Pauline. I'm very grateful for this opportunity. I'm really happy that I'll be joining you for this. And it's great to be part of all the wonderful work you're doing.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
It's so nice to have you. Let's start with Why and Why. I really loved both of your graphic novels. I was struck by each of them in different ways. And so let's start with Why and Why. And for the audience who hasn't yet looked at these books and looked at the novels, one of the first things that struck me about this is it's full of drawings and a few almost what you would call children's rhymes at the beginning of each section. And the sections are titled, let's say, toys or supermarket and things like that. So there's a lot of visual strength and power to these books, but then the writing also is very strong and powerful. For example, this first section that starts, toys, if I may read it, the little just four-line rhyme, alternating rhyme says, I am a toy and he's a soldier, war is real and so is torture. And there's a picture of a stuffed animal, teddy bear, a toy being pulled by two hands, and then a picture of a broken doll afterwards. It's a very jarring juxtaposition of the children's rhyme, the children's theme of toys and war. Can you talk about that jarring and extremely powerful juxtaposition throughout your graphic novel?
Yeah, thank you so much. Yeah, I'll talk about this part and also the art that was used over there. This was written at a time when I was very much under the impact of what was going on in Arab countries, post like 2011 and 2010, in what is referred to as the Arab Spring and the upheavals over there. And I was noticing increasing tension between different groups of people, civil wars happening, ultra-conservative groups, militarization. And this is the whole point behind this first drawing that you referred to, the toy that is being pulled by two hands. One of them is pulling from one side and the other from the other side. And they're supposed to be both in the same place, but what they're actually doing is their conflict or the fight for power is destroying the future of the place or the space itself. Mm-hmm. The idea over here was, like you said, the word jarring is very adequate. So what I have in mind over here is this juxtaposition or this contrast, very sharp contrast between childhood in all its softness and mm-hmm. hopefulness and innocence, as opposed to the violence of scrambling for power or the fight for power with its corruption and violence and ugliness, sheer ugliness.
Yeah, that comes through so powerfully and immediately. That's really amazing. Why and why? Let's talk about the title. The protagonists of this graphic novel are two children, a boy and a girl. And at one point, they find a dog. And I love the dog, I have to tell you. It's so sweet. And it's always looking lovingly at the little kids who are alone in this world of ruin and destruction as they walk through empty, deserted streets. And finally, this dog. But before the dog, maybe the title and then the dog, if you don't mind.
Yeah, of course. The title is Why and Why, the two letters, Why and Why. But when you pronounce it, it can also sound like Why is a question.
Yes.
the two letters were inspired by the names, the first letters of my children's names, Yasmina and Yasin.
Nice.
I guess, like, maybe probably subconsciously at the time, I was worried about them because this was the time when we moved to the United States in 2012. And at the time, I was worried about the future of my children in particular, of course, their generation of what is going on in the world or what could happen. So I had a lot of questions in my mind, and this is where the questions came in, and also the letters of the names.
Yeah.
And I have a daughter and a son. I think somehow this came out in the drawing.
Yeah.
As for the dog, I mean, for me, it symbolizes, I've always been a dog person. I love cats and other pets, but I've always been a dog person. So the dog for me symbolizes an aspect of loyalty and love that at the time I felt was lacking in human beings. Mm. And actually you probably find you're better off with a dog than human friendship in many ways. And this is what you see in the graphic novel with the deserted city that they wake up and find that their city is completely destroyed.
Yeah, it's a completely post-apocalyptic scene that we encounter in this novel with the two children and their innocence and their companionship. They're always together, which is beautiful to see. But, you know, that desolation that they face and the aloneness, they are alone in the world, in a world left in ruins. One page you have a long winding street with just destruction all around it. And it's so powerfully evocative of that loss and the emptiness that the children find themselves in. And then when the dog appears, it's sort of like it gives the reader hope as well as the children, you know, you identify with that. And the drawing, the way you draw the dog too, the dog is almost always looking at the kids, which is beautiful. That connection, that care that is lacking in all the desolation around them. So
yeah, and it's a small dog too. Yeah. It's not like it's a dog that you would expect to protect you, but it's actually more in a sense that they are protecting it that they are companions. And I intended that. So this is not for protection in a physical sense, but it's more like psychological companionship. Yes. Yeah. And I think it's a bit of a motif in Arabic literature where the idea of the journey and you like gather companions as you go ahead. So as you walk, you find this one and they join you, and this one and they join you, and so on. So I think this was somewhere at the back of my mind.
Right. And of course, I mean, the motif of the ruins and the looking upon the ruins, you know, Al-Atlal and all of that.
Yes.
It's evocative of that as well.
Yes.
Both post-apocalyptic, but also looking back at, as you said, the motif of the journey and the motif of the looking upon the ruins and all of that.
Yes. At the time I was teaching like classical Arabic poetry. So,
so you were influenced by that.
I listened to Mukulsum, Al-Atlal or somebody. Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. And that's, you know, that's what I love about this work. It's deeply evocative of Arabic literary traditions, while also it's very contemporary in the moment and futuristic too, and a kind of, unfortunately, post-apocalyptic. If I may also talk a little bit about the ending, do I have permission to talk a little bit?
Please.
Yeah.
I mean, because all the spoilers you want. I don't mind.
Because, you know, I feel like with graphic novels, the way I approach them, I always flip through the pages before I start reading. And so I think this is not really a big spoiler.
No, it's okay.
But if you look at when I first was looking at it, you flip through the pages, the first page is in color. Is this water paint?
Yes, I use watercolors for the colored pages, and for the other ones, I use pencil and ink.
Pencil and ink.
For the black and white.
Very nice. So for the readers who haven't yet picked up this book, the first page gives us a watercolor image of a river and a bridge over it with a mosque and other buildings and palm trees evocative of Egypt, I would say. Then it moves to black and white ink with a few color images here and there. You're going through this and these kids are going through one desolate place after the other, one destroyed place after the other. And then there is the epilogue. And then the epilogue brings us images of the kids. Following that is the memories of why and why. And this is completely in color.
Yes.
And this brings an antidote to all these places that the children had seen, had gone through. For example, the amusement park that was really grotesque and I don't have the words.
Down and even like the supposedly scary parts are actually
really scary.
And they're not scared of them anymore because you have seen real dead bodies. So when they see the scary parts and the amusement park, they're not scared.
They're not scared.
They even take the one of the scary sort of ghosts, like the toys, yes. And they bury it because they're used to seeing bodies.
Yes. We could pause before I could finish this, since you mentioned that point. I paused at that one where they're burying it, and I had to look because it looks like a ghost in the amusement park, and then it looks like a skeleton, and then they bury it. And it was a very powerful moment in reading this novel and seeing what the children are doing, because there's almost a care for this amusement park fixture, right? Yes. That because it comes representative of all these unburied bodies, they show that care, which was really touching and moving. It strikes you as a reader that why are what they're burying? And then, you know, is it a real skeleton? I had to ask myself, like, was it a skeleton of a real person or not?
And no, it's not. The sad thing is, children in this kind of setup, they're used to destruction anywhere. So the toy of a dead person or a skeleton is not that much different from an actual. I mean, they have seen much worse. So
right.
But they would never be terrified of the scary house or the horror right. house in an amusement park.
Because they've seen real horrors.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Very powerful.
Yeah. I like what you're saying, though. If you continue about
the, yeah, so then the epilogue. So we're seeing them go through these like horrible scenes of destruction and loss and violence. Not violence in action, but the aftermath of violence, yes, is what we see throughout. And then we have these colorful images then of exactly those things. For example, the toy store where it was destroyed before with broken toys, broken shelves in black and white ink. Here you have an image of the toy store. The parents are present. They're embracing the kids. The children are carrying big gifts, wrapped gifts, and everything is in color. The amusement park has a fun flying carpet themed ride on yes. it. And there are so many other things. They're going to school. It's all in color. They're smiling. All of these things are the opposite of what happened. And so what struck me about this is that this is a very dystopian work. Yes. And at the end, though, the color gives you hope. But there's another jarring juxtaposition, which is all this is in the past.
Yes.
So the hope that comes at the end is really a memory. So can you talk about that, way that the end is the beginning and the...
Yes. It's, I think part of that is also maybe influenced by my experience and my family's experience as like people moving to another place. So you remember a lot of the good things and where you're coming from, but they become parts of the past, but they're still defining you somehow. But this came out in a different way, in a more violent sort of way. You mentioned violence, and you mentioned that we don't see it, we see the aftermath. And I was very careful not to put any violence mm-hmm. here, because the aftermath sometimes, or actually the aftermath is worse than the violence itself, because people, I mean, who are killed during the violence are gone, but also survive it. One way of looking at it is they suffer actually as much or sometimes even more, because they're the ones who are seeing everything that happened after the violence. What I'm looking at over here is how memory defines them. Are they going to be defined forever? I notice that they are not present at all in their current form when you're looking at the epilogue. Mm-hmm. So those memories might be for us as readers. They're informing us of look what they were like, or maybe they're remembering it. Mm-hmm. And I meant it to be on its own, because the idea over here is that, like you said, the dystopian word or this devolution, or instead of evolving or developing into something better, what is happening is that we are going backwards. Mm. The good things are behind, the bad things are happening right now. Mm. And this is sort of what I meant to have it in, literally, physically at the end of the place. So it is behind. It's,
yes,
it's something that you remember.
Yeah.
And since you mentioned, if I say this quickly, since you mentioned dystopia and post-apocalypse, I always have to get back a little bit to research. I'm very interested in science fiction and apocalypse, because this was what I studied. Actually, and Arabic literature has a lot of that, but it has been ignored for quite some time. I mean, there are some studies into this, and I work on that. And it's more in writing, in novels and in textual literature. But I'm trying to, as much as possible, to introduce that into graphic novels about the Arab world, or about Arabic as well.
Very nice.
Arabic culture.
Yeah, beautiful, beautiful. I think that would be really, really so powerful and so interesting. This is a deeply, deeply moving work. We could talk endlessly about it, but I think I want to shift a little bit to Jamila and then maybe talk about both in relation to each other.
Sure.
Jamila is another graphic novel that you wrote. It's different in feel from YNY,
yes,
and it's in full color throughout. Do you want to give us a little, a reader who hasn't read this, a quick introduction, and then I would like to share a bit of my own initial response to
sure.
it.
Sure. Yeah. Jamila is very different in many ways. It's about a woman. Her name is Jamila, which in Arabic is the Arabic word for beautiful. And she's from Nubia. So she's the south of Egypt with a very peculiar, very unique and wonderful culture. She's very hopeful, but she also goes through certain incidents, including sexual assault. And before that, she felt that she was not valued as the only woman in the family and that she does not get to inherit enough because she's a woman. And there's a critique of that aspect. In the beginning, her mother was very harsh and she was trying to get her to get married and she's young. And I mean, you don't have to pursue all the education, but she also has other friends from the same village. And I intended to make that because I'm not commenting on an entire area, but I'm commenting on a specific family or a group of people because she has her neighbor goes to Cairo and she goes to universities and she's studying. The mother eventually supports her and helps her to leave without anybody sort of knowing about it. So like the men in the family or other people in the family do not object to it. And then we have the rest of her journey. She goes to Cairo, she goes to Alexandria, she finishes college, she goes to graduate school. And there's one picture over there of my advisor in Egypt.
That's great.
Yes, it was like an homage to her.
Beautiful. I wondered about that because there was the specific name given, the full name, and also a more realistic drawing.
Yeah, Amira Nouera, that was my advisor in Egypt. I sort of did a likeness of her, like as an homage to her.
Beautiful.
Yeah, and then after that, she travels to the United States on like conferences. She stays there for a while and she's fascinated by the similarities when she visits the library and she sees images of Egypt and the United States as together in the Jefferson Room in the ceiling. But then as she's walking down the street, she's also assaulted or like harassed by a person. So in a sense, the experience that she faces is replicated wherever she goes. The person who assaulted her in the first part of the journey in her hometown was someone that she was in love with. After she was assaulted, someone from a reading group in the US, as I was in Minnesota, because I was in Minnesota at the time. So I was like sort of looking at it. Someone over there, she likes him a lot. And then eventually she finds out that he was writing a book about her without telling her. Possibly stealing some of her ideas, and he calls the book Saving Jamila, which I'm commenting over here on the traditional, like Eurocentric or Western-centric maybe, view of, or like stereotyping, Orientalist basically, view of Arab women that they need to be saved.
Right.
So she leaves that person as well, and then she decides to go back and to her mother, and she remembers her grandmother. So she becomes more of a global citizen or someone who can travel, go anywhere. She frees herself from all bonds and she's connected to everything. But at the same time, when she was younger, she goes through looking for her identity. And I guess at that time, because this is a later novel, I was thinking of my identity as the identity of my family as people who are moving. Mm-hmm. She reads a lot about ancient Egyptian and Arab heritage as well. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
And then the final scene, as you said, is connecting her to her grandmother, who is telling her, you know, Jamila means beautiful. This is who you are. You know, she kind of goes out to go back and connect to her past, her grandmother, in a beautiful way. She had it from when she was a child, but she had to experience all these things to recognize it in the end.
Yes, so, exactly.
Yeah, that's very
to believe in her name.
To believe in her name. Exactly. Yes. Exactly. Beautiful. Yeah. It comes across very, very strong. As you mentioned, there's a lot of references to classical Arabic poetry, to Western representations of Arabs and women, to ancient Egyptian goddesses. It is almost as if we are taking your class, but integrated into the story of Jamila. But there is so many scenes of references to Arab history, to Egyptian history specifically, and to Orientalism, as you mentioned, to the pillaging of museums. So can you talk a little bit about that? When I introduced you, I mentioned how your academic work, I see it influencing this. And I also see, you mentioned it too, I see some, as I was reading it, I saw some autobiographical aspects to it too. You represent McAllister, college where you were teaching before, and I couldn't help seeing some parallels. Could you talk about that, please?
Yes, thank you. They always say that usually the first novel that a writer writes has is autobiographical in a way, although this one is not the first. But if you look at both works, there are autobiographical elements in them. They are not direct. I mean, the first one has reference to my children. This one has references to aspects of my own journey and also being a woman could be aspects to women in the family as well. And in that sense, the idea of the journey and the idea of being perceived as someone who's different, which I felt probably part of a cultural shock, although my studies and my majors have always been in like American literature and comparative literature and so on, but still living in a place is different from traveling like briefly to it. Well, since you mentioned academics, at the time I was writing my first book, which was collecting all those poems by women. that came into the book very clearly over here, mm-hmm. because I was so much influenced by some of the women poets and their beautiful stories. So I started drawing them, and then I decided to include them in the novel. Some of those were actually paintings that I did before starting working on the novel, like the two poets who are sitting together. There's a woman and a man sitting like in Andalusia in one of those beautiful Andalusian gardens.
Yes.
This was a standalone painting, and then I decided to include it. It looks like a painting on its own.
It does. It looks like a painting on its own, for sure. It's like a scene, you know.
Exactly. Yes. And the same with Qais and Layla. So, as with the ancient Egyptian, this was has always been a fascination of mine. In the second book, academic book, there is a chapter on Naguib Mahfouz's adaptation of Senohi, which is an ancient Egyptian narrative, probably one of the earliest short stories ever written. And Naguib Mahfouz, the Egyptian novelist, adapted it into a modern one. So at that time, I was also researching or looking at that. So I became very interested into looking at all this. I think the idea here is a revisiting of one's culture as mm-hmm. part of the identity. I was developing and trying to understand where I stand. I mean, I grew up in other Arab countries, and then I also lived most of my life in Egypt, and then I came over here. So I've always seen myself as an Egyptian, but also as a global citizen. Mm-hmm. And it's something that I believe I wanted my children to have as well, mm-hmm. for what it's worth. I mean, I've always believed that. And I think this is something that I'm trying to show up over here, that being a global citizen does not mean that you're rootless. It can actually mean that you are even more connected to your roots.
Yes, beautiful. Yeah, I love the way that you convey that. The legacy of scribes, of female scribes in particular, there's, as you suggest in this graphic novel, there's a kind of forgetfulness of women writers, women poets, women's achievements in history. But you really highlight that, the idea of scribes. And there's an image on page 72 of your book where we have an ancient Egyptian scribe and we have Jamila. So at the top half is the ancient Egyptian scribe writing, and the bottom half is Jamila reading a book, and they are both sitting with cross-legged. The images are parallels of one another with a clear sort of evocation of yes. legacy. Can you talk about that a little bit more?
Yes. Jamila over here is unintentionally like replicating or reliving her ancestors. It's like it's part of her subconscious or maybe collective unconscious. If you look at it from, I don't know, a Jungian perspective, that we all have a collective unconscious in a sense. So it's part of her. I mean, every woman or every Egyptian woman, at least what I had in mind, or every Arab woman has those very powerful ancestors in her. And whether she is denied that or whether she is perceived differently from other cultures, that does not mean that she doesn't have it in her. So the way she's sitting, the way she's reading, I always try to connect that to ancient Egyptian figures to Arab poets, for instance, female poets or women poets.
And this is a beautiful way in which the art, the drawings, the watercolors and the text work together. So the pictures are creating a narrative in addition to the text.
Yes, exactly.
They work side by side. It's not an illustration book. It is a true graphic novel where the words and the images are working together to create meaning and depth of meaning. And that's a beautiful aspect of it. Speaking of art, it's beautiful art. And there's a range of art from realistic drawings to more gestural drawing, I would say. As I was looking at it, I think I mentioned it to you when I first saw it. It reminded me of when I was a kid in Lebanon and we had these little paperback, they were, looked like magazines, but they were like little paperbacks and they were illustrated stories of like Sinbad and all of these things. And at the time, I didn't even know they were from The Thousand and One Nights. I discovered that afterwards, you know? but the style is very much reminiscent of that in a lot of the paintings, not all of them. Can you talk about that? Was that intentional or?
Yes. I mean, part of it is intentional. Part of it is also influence. I'm always influenced by what I'm reading or whatever stage I'm going through. A lot of my writing becomes intentional after I start drawing. Like the first one, I probably was more influenced by like American graphic novels, but I'm generally more influenced by bande dessinée, which is French and European graphic novels, and Arabic and Egyptian comic books have been influenced by that as well. Not to mention, of course, that we have the entire region has a history of art that predates any other art, pretty much, or most other art, at least. I particularly this kind of drawing, you know, the combination of text. I mean, I'm thinking of temples where you have drawings in Mesopotamia and Egypt, and you have text next to them. So this idea of using color is important for me in both senses. Also, my family has an influence in all this somehow. Like the first novel, Why and Why, it was actually much shorter and didn't have any dialogue at all, and still doesn't have any dialogue, but it has those poems, or like you said, children's song or lullabies. And it was my family, my four children, who encouraged me to sort of make this bigger, maybe add some writing to it, but I didn't want to do any dialogue, so I sort of adding lullabies and maybe introducing these two chapters. The second one is a more traditional graphic novel, in the sense that it has dialogue and it has description and it has people speaking to each other. And I think the colors over here are an influence of my father in particular. Mm-hmm. He was an academic, he was a professor, but he was also a graphic novel artist in the 1950s and 60s. And I was always fascinated by his drawing, and I always do some kind of archival work with my nephews, and we look at some of those, and I have kept some of them, and I've been scanning many of them.
Nice.
There is a huge movement, by the way, for comic book collectors in Arab countries. Yes. Egypt and many other Arab countries have had some of those. And Egypt, when you talked about Sinbad, I remembered Bikar, Hassan Bikar, who was an Egyptian painter who decided to get into graphic novels, and he simplified his art and the lines he uses. So I've been very much influenced by that. And at the time, I was reading those. So when I came here, it was a lot easier in the United States to find comic books and to be able to look at the different styles. I'm even teaching a course now on comparing the different styles, like manga as Japanese comics compared to bande dessinée or BD, the European comics. And I guess I was experimenting with styles.
Beautiful, beautiful. Yeah, that's really nice. Thank you for that background. Sure. That really comes through. It's interesting to see all of that in one text. Another thing that comes through here is, in both books, is the idea of the library. The library figures very prominently in both books. And can you talk about the importance of the library to you and in your work?
Yes. Thank you for mentioning that. I'm very passionate about books. I'm a very bookish person. I mean, I'm mostly...
You're in good company.
I'm in good company. I'm sure you are. I mean, you just got us shelves for our center over here. I know the audience can see it, but yeah, you're introducing our own little library in the center. So you know exactly how I feel. I have a big library in my apartment in Egypt, and my father grew up with books all over the place, and grew up with books in our house in Egypt. Egypt, or Alexandria in particular, that's my city, or city I've lived in most of my life, and my parents are from there. Has the Library of Alexandria, whether historically or the more recent one, the modern one, which is just an amazing place. I mean, anybody who hasn't seen it, I mean, really should go and look at it. I believe libraries can save lives and can save entire nations if people take care of them carefully. And in Why, the two children decide eventually to live in the library and to lock themselves in. So they've been around. Like you said, they go from one place to the other and see everything that they have been. They are revisiting the places they go to. Like their school, they find it destroyed with bullet holes on everywhere. On the whiteboard, they go to the amusement park and so on, and they go to the beach and wherever they go. So eventually, when they see a dead body or they see a group of soldiers and a group of people fighting in the distance, they get terrified and they decide, that's it, we're done. So they run into the library. And the last page of that, before the epilogue, I show them a little bit grown up. So they're closer to teenagers and children. Yes. And the library around them is closed. And they managed to get whatever they could save from a museum that was looted. So they got whatever is left from that museum, and they put everything that's related to culture inside, and they decide to stay in the library. I mean, they might stay there until they die. If you speculate about the darker side, you can get there. But they're going to lock themselves up in the library. In Jamila, she has access to wonderful libraries. And even the connection she makes between the United States and Egypt, she makes it in Jefferson's loom in the library.
Yes, yes.
Like the biggest Library of Congress, the biggest library. And also when she gets her degree from Egypt, she goes and visits the Alexandria Library, or she was there before going to the US. So I'm trying to connect libraries. I feel that the whole world is connected through libraries.
Yeah.
It's probably the one thing that can connect everybody.
Mm-hmm. That's very interesting. Yeah. And you even refer to Nooks and Kindle books and things like that. So there are different ways of reading, right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
The physical book is beautiful to handle, but there's also other ways of reading passing on.
Yeah, I was referring to that. I'll say it real quick. I was referring to that in probably in a darker setting.
You were.
Yeah, in the why. Yeah. But it has the same idea, because I was looking at how, at least if they ever burn books, we will still have Kindles and Nooks.
Yes.
Yeah, it says, I used to love paper books, but now I love Kindles and Nooks. At least I'd still be able to read when they burn old books.
That's right.
This is a reference to book burning generally, or book banning, which I'm very much against in many ways. Yeah.
Yes. And it's an issue everywhere you go, in Arab countries and in the US.
Yes.
And it's an ongoing debate and struggle.
That's true.
Yeah, yes. Absolutely. Yeah, very, very nice. Yeah, thank you for that. The library theme comes through very prominently and powerfully in both these works. Also, Jamila becomes an artist too, not just a book person, right?
Yes, that's true.
And that's where I was thinking, okay, she knows a lot about Arabic literature, comparative, and an
she
artist,
so
it made me think of you. Which is beautiful to be able to do that. You talked to her about her as an artist, and then you mentioned a few times the connection between your process, how you start with drawing versus writing. Can you talk about that too?
Yes. One of the things that I found really interesting is that she's a woman, and writing that I was sort of looking for different aspects of my life from her perspective as well. But there's a lot of what's happening over here. Things that I have experienced, like sense of alienation, like moving from one plane to another. A lot of what she has in a very physical sense, like assault, I did not experience physically, but I experienced them in like maybe psychologically or feeling like being treated unfairly. The Orientalism, of course, and the way you're treated as someone from a different culture. This is something that a lot of people go through anyway. The process for me, I always go for the drawings first. Sometimes I have certain words in mind and then I try to draw those. But it's usually the drawing comes first. When I'm doing an entire graphic novel, the narrative comes in my mind. So I have like a narrative in mind. Usually I have a general storyline that I have in mind and I then start putting that in paper and then I change it. And I'm very good at changing sort of the storyline if I don't like it. If I order these, I would say the storyline comes first and then the drawing and then the writing, but that is in order, temporal order, which comes first. But which is more important for me, or which really controls everything eventually, it is the art and then the writing and then the storyline. So I can always change the storyline after the art.
Yeah.
If I feel that I really need to get this perspective or I need to get the light over here, I'm going to do two or three panels of that. And come on, the storyline can wait. I mean, I can linger in this one. I try to experiment a lot. So I try to be a little bit cinematic sometimes. And other times I try to be very intuitive and like, in a psychological kind of way, like with Why and Why, but more linear way that in Jamila.
Definitely. Yeah. Thank you. You mentioned the aspect of gender. There's the gender, class, race that comes in Jamila very, very strongly. The focus on women's history. And so can you talk about what drew you to focus on a woman figure, female figure, and a female figure from the south of Egypt, given the history of gender discrimination, race, also the village versus the urban, all of these class divides and things like that? What drew you to a female figure, given all the autobiographical elements that you mentioned?
Yes, because for me, I felt that a female figure from this part of the world is at the heart of stereotyping. And I've always been very careful with stereotype. Female figures in an Arab country, in a North African country, I mean, whether Muslim or not, but in this part of the world, including a Muslim person, would be usually pictured as someone who's victimized constantly, someone who's backwards, someone who's uneducated, someone who is treated in a certain way, someone who needs to be saved. Well, if you look at historically, even in modern times, I mean, in spite of those things happening, there are scientists, great writers, academics, professors, including my own advisors, my own professors. I mean, I graduated from the English department. And while you get this divide between STEM and humanities everywhere, that there are more women professors or academics in the humanities as opposed to engineers and doctors, which is also part of the stereotyping. But this is also, for me, from my experience, meant that my professors, most of them were women. This image of women being less educated or of women pictured differently from people who do not know the culture, I was trying to fight that. And this is why I chose the journey to be that of a woman. Mm-hmm. I wanted to connect that to the past. And I also wanted to make sure that people would know that it's happening even in the present. This kind of progress, this kind of triumph that she has, which is not only against her own culture, but it's actually against expectations and misrepresentations of her culture.
Absolutely. The connection between her experiences in the United States, let's say, and her experiences in Egypt are paralleled in many ways, while at the same time being nuanced to the specific circumstances.
Yes.
The patriarchy or misogyny shows itself differently in different contexts, but it's still misogyny and patriarchy.
Yeah, exactly. Like stealing her ideas for a book or stealing her life for a book, which happened in an American sort of context or in a Western context. That's still assault in a way. Assault in an intellectual way,
right.
Maybe. And she was physically assaulted in those places.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. There is that image on page 93 of Jamila, where again, the drawing, the illustrations are really powerfully evocative of the content of the text. And we have an image of a belly dancer at the top with sort of diaphanous veils. But on her wrist, there's a cloth, let's say, yeah, that then goes down to the bottom half of the image, and it's a woman in black hijab.
Yes.
And I don't think you're saying people shouldn't be in hijab, but I think what you're saying is that this idea that we only see women in binaries as either sexualized or completely covered up, it's still focusing on women's bodies. And Jamila's face is in the middle, sort of looking like she can't deal with this. Is how I would
leave it alone. Yeah.
Yeah. Where do I belong? Exactly. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yes. This guy had a mind. I wasn't really commenting on what people or what women should or should not be wearing, because if I did that, I would be doing exactly the same thing I'm criticizing. What
exactly
I'm looking at over here is women being sexualized in either case. I mean, covering them up or not covering them up or critiquing what they're wearing in either way is still talking on their behalf, mm-hmm, and making the conversation about the way they look and not who they are or what they're thinking of, and like stealing the narrative from them.
Mm.
I'm very invested in the idea of stealing the narrative or mm-hmm of like writing your own narrative. And not allowing people to take that, because this has been done to women, but also to men and to people, to minorities, to people from different places. Look at history books, and you can have two history books by two different people from two different cultures about the same period, and you read very different things.
Yeah, I love the way you put that, the investment in how narratives are stolen, right, and stealing the narrative, and that plagiarism from the one writer, but also the pillaging of the museums, and in so many ways that is connected.
Yes, true.
Well, Wissam, I could spend another hour talking to you about these narratives.
Much. I could spend another hour talking to you. I mean, yeah, thank you so much.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. Thank you
so much. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Today's episode was hosted by Pauline Homsey-Vincent. It was produced by Hamad Jafar and Esma Baban, and edited by Hamad Jafar. Our theme song was composed by Isra Darwish, and our logo was created by Maisara Abdul Haq. Sin Jim is brought to you by the Center for Arab American Studies at the University of Michigan Dearborn and the Arab American National Museum. Sin Jim is funded by the University of Michigan Arts Initiative and the Center for Arab American Studies at the University of Michigan Dearborn. Check out our website, sinjimpodcast.org, for more information on our guests and to view videos of their readings. Thank you for listening.